G'day everybody, welcome to Tactical Tennis.
I'm Jacob Meyer.
And I'm Glenn Hill. And in the last podcast episode, we went over the idea of finding an accurate representation of your strengths or weaknesses as a player, because one of the big challenges of tennis is people tend to think about their own game in terms that aren't actually an accurate reflection of their game. That was a weird way to say that, but let's run with it.
But it makes sense, right? Like, we just have it's hard to play a sport like tennis that demands so much out of an athlete and also do all the appropriate sports psychology stuff and manage all your mental skills and also have a complete awareness of everything that you're doing or not doing on the court and also strategize and use all the tactics to play the chess game that, you know, live matches really are out there.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that makes tennis so hard to understand and makes it so hard for us to accurately understand our own games is how sophisticated the sport is and how variable it is. I mean, if I could hit 20 forehands, and unlike some other sports, those 20 forehands could be very, very different in nature. And so picking out patterns from amongst that data becomes very difficult. So if I'm a baseball player, as an example, like baseball's a very simple sport, relatively speaking. You know, we have a series of discrete events. You know, the pitcher throws a pitch, the batter tries to hit it, then the fielders try to catch the ball and get the batter out. I mean, the pitcher doesn't get to throw two pitches like straight after each other. It's not like he pitches, the batter hits it back to him, he pitches it right again. They're not going back and forth. I mean, these are single events. And so it's hard. Like in baseball, you can't pretend you're a good hitter. It's hard to say, well, I'm a great hitter and have a wrong idea of how good of a hitter you are when it's very clear whether or not you're a good hitter because it's a very simple statistic. You have a batting average,
right.
Or you have an on-base percentage.
You know.
And that's it. And you either have a good batting percentage and a good on-base percentage, or you don't. And if those numbers are bad, then it's very hard to argue with. Where in tennis, it's a little more complicated because you've got forehands and backhands and volleys and slice backhands and serves and overheads. Well, and you can hit an infinite number of variations of each of these shots.
And there's so many things. I mean, we still have people arguing that Roger Federer doesn't have a good backhand.
Or even, I think almost more comically to me, people arguing that suddenly he has a new backhand and that his backhand used to not be good and suddenly it's gotten great.
Which definitely isn't the case.
No, but I think we brought that example up last episode of, that's an example of somebody not having a good understanding of one aspect of the game. So that was what the episode was about, was giving you all some tools and a means with which to go about and understand your game. And once you have that understanding, the next step, which is what today's episode is about, coincidence I'm sure, is putting those strengths and weaknesses together into a plan. If you think of last time we talked about strokes as being jigsaw piece puzzles, well, now we try to take those pieces and put them together and make a picture that makes sense. Right? We don't want to make a giraffe that has, you know, four heads on the bottom of its legs and a hoof on the top of its neck and six tails.
As soon as you started this example, I knew it was going to be great. Like, I have no idea what you just said because I'm cracking up over
Great. Let's pretend that was great and run with it. It'll be fun.
It's really good. Just make sure to leave that one in the episode. Whatever you do, don't edit that one out. So here's my question to you.
Sure.
How do we bridge the gap from, okay, I'm buying what you're selling here. I went off, I played some practice sets, I followed some of the ideas from last episode. I got some data, okay? Now I have some data
on
my own game.
If you did that, folks, you just put yourself in the top 1% of tennis players looking to improve, right? Because
Without doing anything else, you're a better player now. Congratulations.
Right. And also, that's rare company because very few people will actually do that. But sorry, finish your question.
Okay, so let's say I did this. I went out and I got some data. I got some feedback on my own game. So I'm a little bit less in my own head, so to say, right? And now I'm looking at this data going, okay, I got a list of things I'm good at. I got a list of things I'm not good at. How do I bridge that gap into a style of play or a strategy for going out there and winning matches?
Fair enough. So really, to me, this starts... I'm going to answer your question with two questions. How about that? So question number one...
I can't wait.
Question number one is, how am I going to win points? And that's where the strengths part of our self-analysis, our self-assessment comes in, right? If I am 6 foot six and I have a big serve and I have a big forehand, then it's not so hard to figure out this basic idea of how I'm going to win points. I'm going to win points by hitting big serves that don't come back, or by hitting big serves that do come back, after which I then hit a big forehand that doesn't come back. Maybe two forehands, maybe three forehands, but essentially I'm going to use my big serve to start the point either with a serve, with ending the point right there, start the point with ending the point, or start the point with a serve that gives me a weak enough response. I can then use my big forehand to end things in the next shot or two. That would be an example of how I'm going to win points. Now, look, we're going to go more into detail on that. That's not the be-all and end-all. But this is...
Okay, guys, podcast over. Have a great week.
Yeah. No, but this is the idea of like getting a basic philosophy of the type of tennis that we want to be playing. So in this sense, I want to be playing points that are short and aggressive. Now, the second question then, and you don't get a prize if you figured out what the second question is, which is... how am I going to lose points? So I'm the 6 foot six guy with the big serve and the big forehand. Well, guess what? I also have a weak backhand and I don't move very well. And so I'm going to lose points making errors off my backhand, and I'm going to lose points by not being able to transition off of defense because my movement doesn't let me get in position quickly enough to essentially transition and shift from defense to offense. So that's how I'm going to lose points. So then answering the kind of follow-on part of that from a philosophical question, what I don't want to do is I don't want to play long points, because the longer the rally goes, the better the odds that I'm going to hit a backhand, and also the better the odds at some point I'm going to end up on defense, right? And so these two things dovetail together quite nicely and give me that answer of, I want to play short, aggressive points. And so that gives me a philosophical basis with which to start a more in-depth, more sophisticated development of a game plan. But that's where I start. If I'm a smaller guy who's very fast and maybe doesn't have any big weapons but also is very consistent, well, you're going to want to play long, engaged points. And hopefully with a little more running. I mean, essentially a lot of the times it comes down to this question of, what do I do better than the other person? And then you make the match about the thing that you do better than them.
Do better, right. So maybe this is jumping ahead, and maybe people are going to think that this doesn't make any sense at all. But the quick background...
That's a promising way to lead in.
I know. This could be the worst advice that you've ever heard. It's not really advice, though, so, you know, whatever. I grew up actually not playing tennis so much when I was young, but playing chess as a game. So maybe that's why I see tennis as a little bit of a chess match. But in this side of the world, at least, we generally think of chess as being the sort of stereotypical strategic game, right? So there's almost infinite combinations of possible chess moves and games and, you know, whatever. And in a way, tennis is just like that. So there's no way that we're going to be able to go through in a podcast every pattern, every situation, every category, you know, every option that everyone is going to need in order to answer all these questions for themselves. But my
hope
is that we can
do... is that we're not going to be able to answer all the questions for people. But hopefully what we can do is put things in a framework where they can fill in the gaps for themselves.
Yeah, that's my hope, is that you can look at least how we're going about this process and start to get a better handle on, okay, you know, how do I win points? And then what goes on my list of things that I know I am not supposed to do?
Yes.
And hopefully that starts to actually take steps towards making you a better player. So.
Okay. Yeah, so we've got this broad philosophical sense of, do I want to play, am I going to be at a very aggressive player, or am I going to be a more defensive player? These are the two broad categories that we can essentially turn tennis players into, the average player. Because even when you take players that are more complete, you take players on the professional tour that have been number one in the world, they might be able to do both, but everybody tends to fall into one category or the other as their baseline philosophy. You know,
this seems to be where we get that idea of a pusher.
Right. Well, this ties back into this whole idea. Last time we talked about how people will tend to either overemphasize or focus too much on the winners that they hit and kind of have a poor memory for the errors they make, or the other way around. That kind of underlying emotional lens with which we see the game also colors the way that we play the game. If I'm the type of person who is very focused on the winners and I forget about the errors, I'm probably an aggressive player. And if I'm the type of person who's very risk averse and I remember, you know, I go to sleep at night tossing and turning, muttering about the missed, you know, unforced backhand error I made at 3-all in the third set, I'm probably a very defensive type minded player. And this is why I think we can have people sometimes who end up playing tennis, that a style of tennis that's actually very contrary to the actual tools they have at their disposal, because a player might have the weapons to be an offensive player, but the emotional disposition to be a more defensive player. And so they go out, and despite the fact that they have all these tools to play offense with, they go out and play defensive tennis and of course don't ever play to their potential. And so we have to understand, like, look, you have to take that into account when you are finally putting together your philosophy and your game plan, because it can be difficult to go out and play a style of tennis that goes against your emotional grain.
Yes.
But either way,
really difficult.
You do have to, hopefully you can overcome that, but that's kind of, I think, maybe an episode for another podcast.
That actually sounds like a really great, like, oh, I just want to dive into this sport.
I really do. Like, I almost started to, but I think we shouldn't go down that rabbit hole, because is a rabbit hole.
We're not going to go down that, I think, right now. There's more than enough to talk about with the patterns and the things that we want to hit right here. The one thing that I'll say, hopefully this transitions us a little bit, like a nice first volley. Wow, that's the – cut that out. hopefully – and now I know you're not actually going to cut it out. Like, it's just going to be on there. Like, hey, guess who's not funny?
Yeah.
The one thing that I'll try and do with my players sometimes is, like, a guy might think, like, man, like, you know, he has a pusher kind of mentality, not in the sense that he's totally thinks like I'm a pusher, but just in the sense that he hates mistakes, hates to miss balls. And the goal is to make balls. The goal is not to end points quickly. The goal is make the ball. And then, like, hopefully you can win the point later on. Sometimes, though, those players have a really great strength. And so we try to look at the data then. And when a player has the feedback, they can say, oh, well, I have this one shot that I can hit that everyone seems to think is like a winning shot. It's this really aggressive shot, but I make it all the time, right? Sure. So that player doesn't have to think of the shot as being aggressive or as being high risk or
well, that's the thing. I think they can think of it as being aggressive. They shouldn't think of it as being risky.
Right. And so it can still fit within that emotional safe space of, okay, well, if I see myself as someone who needs to not make too many mistakes, then, well, here, you know, you set yourself up to hit this shot that everyone else hates because it's aggressive to the other person.
Right.
Your opponent finds it aggressive.
But the risk-reward is very good.
It's safe.
Yeah, sure.
Right.
Absolutely. So once we have this kind of broad philosophical idea of, do I want to be more of an aggressive player or more of a defensive player, you know, there are a few rare individuals. And look, even some very defensive players will eventually transition to offense. And, you know, a lot of them tend not to come out with that. That's their first thought is attack, attack, attack. That's... You also, even within those categories, there's subcategories, so to speak. I mean, I can be an aggressive player, but that could look like Andre Agassi, who was a very aggressive baseliner, hitting powerful shots off both wings, camping the baseline, taking the ball early, robbing time away. Or it could also look like Pat Rafter, who's serving and volleying first and second serves at the French Open. And those are both variants of an aggressive player. And we shouldn't kind of lose sight of the fact that there's room for a lot of different... That could look a lot of different ways. It can have a lot of different looks.
That's kind of the beauty of the sport to me. And that's one of the ways in which... I mean, I see so many patterns. That's the infinite patterns of tennis, the way that I talk about the infinite patterns of chess games.
Absolutely, absolutely. So now let's talk a little bit about some more specific stuff, right? Because that's all well and good to understand, hey, I want to be an aggressive player. So does that mean you go out and hit every ball as hard as you can? No, that's not at all what it means, okay? So don't do that. Don't be that person, because then you're just going to go out and make a lot of mistakes, right? What you then have to do is start to get a little bit more specific, because as we talked about last time, very few players have genuinely complete strokes. And so if your forehand is big but it's very flat, well, guess what? You can't attack on every single ball, because if the ball's low and you're a little bit stretched and you get aggressive on that shot when you have very little topspin, well, you're going to make a lot of mistakes. Whereas if you wait and get the ball that's shoulder high and you're 3 feet inside the baseline and you're set up well, you can absolutely pull the trigger and probably be very happy. Well, probably not very happy, but at least be content knowing that you made the right decision, even if you missed the shot. Right?
You know, this is one of the things that I always struggled with when I was a younger player. I thought, okay, you know, I had these guys telling me, like, wait for your shot, wait for your shot, wait for your shot. And what I like about the way that you're talking about this now is that you're not saying wait for your shot. You're saying actively do things to set up your shot, which is a different thing than waiting around. If someone has, I mean, if you can't tell, I had a very aggressive, like, slap happy mindset, right? So waiting wasn't my strong suit.
Right.
But if you gave me a task and said, like, here, like, slice your backhand down the line and look for that forehand that you can take inside the baseline, I mean, I could do that in a very engaged way.
Yeah, so this is how that we know that you and I have spent way too much time talking about this, is because I didn't even say that yet, but that's what I was about to say. And she just totally jumped the gun on me, which is, yeah, so our next step is, look, if you know that your forehand is the one you want to pull the trigger on, and you know you can't pull the trigger on every ball, then going that one step deeper is working towards creating the shot that you do get to pull the trigger on. You know, we want to be actively creating our opportunities at every given moment. And so this is where patterns really start to come into play, okay? Because if we take the classic example of, like, you know, what do we think of as kind of a prototypical professional American men's tennis player, he's going to have a big serve, he's going to have a big forehand, he's going to have a mediocre backhand, and fairly mediocre volleys, okay? And so if I'm that player, that gives me a very kind of clear identity as a player, and it also gives me a fairly clear sense of, like, a plan A attack, okay, which is to land my big first serve, and if it comes back, it's probably a weaker reply, and then to attack or hit an attacking forehand with my first forehand, my first ball after the serve, my plus one, so to speak, and then continue to use the forehand as needed because I'm being aggressive, I'm in control of the point, until the point is over. That's my plan A, okay? That would be my pattern might be a serve out wide on the deuce court followed by a forehand into the backhand corner, end of point. That might be my plan A pattern on the deuce court.
Right.
But what happens if plan A doesn't work? Maybe the return is a little bit deep. I need to have a plan B. I need to have a plan C. I need to, if I'm going to be really good at this, I want to have contingency plans and backup patterns and what I term as a decision tree to help me get to the point where I'm hitting the forehand that I really actually want to be hitting. And so if you haven't been to the website yet and checked out the latest article on Alex Demina, it's worth a look, because this is something that he does a very good job of, which is...
Yeah, he does a really nice job of structuring play towards his strengths.
Absolutely. The guy wants to be hitting forehands. He's very aggressive off the forehand. And his forehand's good. It's not the greatest forehand in the history of the sport, but it's good. It's a very good shot. His backhand is a little more limited, but what he does is just always shuffle play, shift play off his backhand and kind of encourage his opponent to hit into his forehand side. Okay? Yeah. And in doing so, then creates the opportunity to hit the shot that he wants to be hitting. And so this is the second part of this. When we talk about these patterns, is there, your patterns should always be shifting in the right direction. So if your opponent gets a shot to your weaker side, then you immediately initiate one of your patterns that's designed to get play back onto your strength again. So that might be rolling a deep, high backhand cross court, expecting a deep high ball back, which you then run around and hit the inside out forehand on. If you can't, right. Now not everybody can hit a deep high cross court backhand.
Yeah, I was going to say, what do you do if you were like me and you didn't have that shot?
Right, well maybe then you hit a slice backhand down the line, which then is going to encourage him to run across and hit a forehand cross court into your forehand. Maybe right. If you don't have that shot, maybe you hit a slice short and angled cross court. Maybe you hit the backhand up the middle. Like, there are options available to you, and there's a lot of variations that can end up with play being on your forehand. What you don't want to do is play a shot that solidifies the pattern into your weakness. So if I don't hit a great cross court backhand, my opponent's going to be able to attack my backhand again, because by going cross court myself, I've opened up more and more angle for them to get at my backhand. It becomes harder and harder for me to hit a forehand at that point.
Right. So you're essentially working against your own patterns.
Right. And this is where a lot of people make mistakes. They think, well, my backhand isn't very good, so I'm going to play a really safe cross-court backhand. Well, every time I hit a backhand cross-court, if it's not the right type of backhand that exposes something in your opponent's game or encourages them to hit a predictable shot back, then all you're really doing is maintaining a holding pattern in a situation that's bad for you. Because if you hit a mediocre cross-court backhand, it's very easy for them to come back at your backhand again. Whereas I can hit a mediocre cross-court backhand, but if it's high and loopy and relatively deep, then it's harder to attack. I'm going to have more time to respond to the next ball. It gives me the opportunity to run around and hit a forehand on the next shot. Or if I hit the short low slice, maybe, if they're not really good at picking that low ball up, then I can get a forehand off the next ball. But the other thing is, it might be in your best interest just to take that backhand down the line and not even do a great job of it, but do it so that... go ahead, yeah.
I want to stop you right there, because I can tell you, I mean, we grew up playing junior tennis on literally on completely different sides of the world, right? So you were in Australia and I was in Florida.
Yeah.
I had to think for a moment there. But I very much grew up in a tennis culture where the backhand was really split into three categories. There was a defensive slice, okay? Mm-hmm. There was the cross-court topspin backhand. And then down-the-line backhands were supposed to be winning shots. Not, right. Oh, you can use this to set yourself up. But like going down the line was essentially... you're trying to end the point. You're hitting a winner. You're hitting it flat, or you're doing whatever, right?
Sure.
But the way you're talking about it, you're saying, well, if I'm playing the cross court backhand and, you know, if I kind of hit it not all the way cross court, or if I don't maybe catch it great, or if I maybe mishit it a little bit, then all of a sudden this guy can attack me however he wants to and I'm in a bad position, right?
Right.
Where it sounds like you're saying that there's more precise, there's more precise patterns that I can try. Where, I mean, if I just hit a junky ball down the line, I mean, he's probably not gonna hit a winner cross court into my forehand.
Well, here's the trick, right? If I hit a junky ball down the line, knowing that he's probably hitting the next ball to my forehand,
right.
The odds of him being able to actually hit a winner over there are significantly lower. And that's a huge part of this is essentially what we're doing is we're remaining in control of the flow of play by intentionally hitting a backhand down the line. If I happen to accidentally, you know, like if I'm trying to go cross court and I just hang one in the middle, well, you know, I'm not going to have made predictive movement ahead of time. I'm not going to be kind of cued and ready and kind of waiting for this next shot. It's going to be panic mode. You're going to be reactive. It's going to be like, oh God, I just gave him the ball he's going to attack me on. Whereas if I, mm-hmm. you know, intentionally put a ball up the line, knowing the next one's going cross court, I can kind of be leaning a little bit. I can be ready to go. I've really primed myself to respond to this next shot. In essence, I'm kind of baiting him a little bit, or her, into hitting into my strength by giving them an opportunity to kind of attack me. But they're going to attack me at my best shot in a way where I know it's coming. And that completely changes that dynamic.
In that sense, for most of us, if you take your strength, right? So in this example, we're using the forehand. My forehand's my strength. But it seems like for most tennis players, if you have a strength and you know where the ball's going and you know you get to use your strength, then we can handle a lot. I mean, you can handle basically most shots.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you look at Alex Demidov, he literally invites people to attack his forehand because he's fast and his forehand's good. And he's not going to win the point every time he does this. But still, his right. odds of winning the point inviting opponents to attack his forehand are still better than letting his opponent attack his backhand. And that's really the key idea here is, people, if you're going to lose a point hitting your best shot. Don't lose a point. Yeah. Don't let somebody beat you with you hitting your worst shot. Let them beat you with you hitting your best shot.
That gets really disheartening if I'm trying to hit high, loopy cross-court backhands, you know, 50 times. Honestly, I mean, those are the days when tennis is depressing, and it's just like, oh, geez, this sucks.
Well, it's depressing for you, but for that defensive-minded individual who hits a good, heavy cross-court backhand and, you know, is super fit and wants to be out there today, that might be heaven. You and I both know somebody we've played with a lot who literally that's all he wants to do is go out and hit high cross-court backhand.
I know exactly who you're talking about. Yeah. I mean, for some guys, that really is. I mean, it's so funny. I mean, in the same way, like, if someone was going to play me and they were going to challenge me to hit slice down the line all day, I mean, it would just be like a kid in a candy store.
Right.
I'd say, oh, this is, you know, sure.
But this is fun. This is a really important truth, though, is that people tend to like doing things that they're good at.
Yes.
Right. And so this brings us back to this whole idea of using patterns to shift play, because what you don't want to do is be out there doing the thing that your opponent likes to do, and especially the thing that they do better than you, right?
So is this a bad time to talk about the sort of other side of the coin of this strategic thought process? You know, where we've said, okay, let's focus on doing the things that we do well.
Mm-hmm.
If we can identify the things that our opponent does well, like say it's someone that we've played before and we know what their strengths are, how much do we need to think about, hey, I want to make decisions so that they never get to do any of their favorite stuff?
Well, we want to think about that a lot. And there's always this balancing act, right? I don't want to obviously play tennis on their terms. And really, any genuinely competitive tennis match ultimately is this struggle between two people each trying to do the thing that they do well. And honestly, it's very, very rare that that ends up with the pattern of play exactly the way both players want it to be, right? Because if we're both aggressive players, well, you know, I want to be the one who's hitting the first strike. I want to be the one who's hitting my forehand into your backhand. And you probably want the same thing, as in you're hitting your forehand into my backhand. And then we're fighting over who gets to do that. And the person who gets to do that the most is probably going to win. Likewise, if I'm the kind of more defensive-minded player, look, my goal might be to not miss. But as a part of that, I also don't want somebody to be out there hitting winners on me all day long.
Right.
I mean, I want to kind of be holding my opponent into a relatively neutral space. And if I get the opportunity to attack them, great. But if they get impatient or make poor decisions and go for the shot they shouldn't go for and make errors, then, you know, they're doing my job for me. Right? I don't have to attack them. And so, you know, we always do want to avoid our opponent getting into the patterns that they like. But really what this comes down to ultimately is understanding the patterns that they like is a huge part in getting the patterns that you like. Because, again, you know, if I'm going to slide that backhand down the line expecting them to attack me cross court, well, what happens if their favorite shot is a down the line forehand?
Then I probably miscalibrated my strategy.
Right.
Or my tactics. Not my strategy, miscalibrated my tactics
right.
for sure.
Absolutely. And so important is to recognize that quickly, because what you don't want to do is go out there and stay out there and keep doing this play and be like, well, why isn't he hitting the ball into my forehand? Well, guess what? You're not the only thinking human being on the court. You know, there's another guy or girl out there who also happens to like winning.
Has a brain.
Yeah, and they also probably want to play well and do the
everybody,
things they do well.
Everybody likes winning. We all like doing the stuff we're good at, and we all like winning.
Yeah, so, you know, you definitely are going to be trying to understand their patterns, especially insofar as it lets you predict what they're going to do, because if I predict what you're going to do, I'm a step ahead of you. If I'm a step ahead of you, then I'm probably going to beat you.
That's well said.
Thanks.
This is one of those places that I, yeah, that I like to encourage people to really keep track of the details of their matches, right? So that might mean after a match, keeping a little journal and taking a couple notes on your opponent and trying to remember, man, like, he really killed me with this shot or that shot. It might also mean keeping a little piece of paper on the changeovers and thinking, okay, well, how did she, you know, win points in the last service game that she had? And it, you might be able to pick up pretty quickly, oh man, like, she's only winning points with her forehand.
Or she's only winning points when I try and hit backhands down the line and make errors of it. Right? I mean, there's that could be great for making in-match adjustments. And look, the thing at the end of the day is just like we talked about people tending to fall into two broad categories of attacking and defensive, and then there's kind of these subcategories inside of that. There are very few Fabrice Santoros out there, right? There are very, very few Fabrice Santoros out there, but there are a lot of players out there who play in the model of Andy Roddick when he was young. There are a lot of players out there who play in the model of, goodness gracious, let's just say Pat Rafter. There are players out there who play in the model of Leighton Hewitt. They may not be carbon copies. They may not do as good of a job.
Right.
But there's a degree to where they're trying to do the same kinds of things and they have the same style of play. So if you can take notes after your matches and start to recognize how a certain style of player matches up with you and the types of patterns that work well for you against that style of player and the ones that you think should work well but don't, and then change them, then things are going to go a lot better for you. Because this is the other big part of it is, look, I mean, it's great to have a working model, right? I mean, I want to go out in court and I'm going to have patterns. I mean, if I'm going to go out and play, I have strategies to shift play off my backhand and my forehand. And they're my go-to strategies, my plan A. And I have my plan B and I have my plan C. But I also need to recognize that there might be a better way to do the same thing. And if I'm not paying attention, if I'm not going to periodically evaluate how play is flowing, then I'm passing up the opportunity to optimize the patterns that I'm using for my particular game. Because even if you, let's just say, fit the exact model of what we just talked about, and you go out there and you use the patterns that we talked about for that specific model of player, those are a starting point. But, you know, you're going to have peculiarities about your own game that you need to adapt your patterns to. And that's a critical piece of the puzzle.
Yeah, and, you know, before I ask you what else we need to cover in this topic right now, I just want to take a moment to sort of pause and sit back. And if we ask ourselves, okay, I mean, all of these things that we've talked about make sense, right? Like, they're simple concepts. But if we ask ourselves, how often am I actually thinking about this the last time I was out there on the court, right?
Yeah.
Most of us, if we're being honest, if you're being honest with yourself, most of us are going to say not that much. Or if I am thinking about it, how much am I thinking about it really to the standard or at the level that I want to be thinking about it, right?
Yeah.
Most of us have a lot of work to do here where we get caught up in the competition. We want to win so badly that we're not really using this process of making adjustments and learning and making not changes to our game, but helping the process influence our decision-making and the way we're playing matches.
Yeah, I would say maybe not changes to our game, but changes to the way in which we employ the tools that we have.
Yes.
Right. And, you know, that's a really good point. And I think that speaks to a lot of kind of bigger picture issues. There's a part to where, I mean, health and fitness, it's not rocket science. There's a lot of very simple, plainly understood diets and exercise programs that are guaranteed to get people fit and strong and healthy. And yet it's hard to actually go out there and do them. I mean, it takes a lot of energy. It takes intent.
Yes.
And that's why, you know, I said earlier, if you actually went out and did the things that we talked about in the previous episode of,
right,
you know, either recording a match or talking to people about your game, just basically taking those steps to understand your own strengths and weaknesses accurately, then you're already significantly ahead the vast majority of tennis players, because most people will never make that effort. And if you do make that effort, if you're in a space where you're able to make that effort, then you've put yourself way ahead of the other people that are currently at the level that you're playing at, because you've just in one step shown that you're not going to remain at that level forever.
Yeah. Yeah. There were coaches that I can remember that used to watch me play some, and then they would make comments like, oh man, like you'd be so good, except like you keep getting tight on that put away ball, or, you know, you just choked on that, you know, that backhand. Well, looking back, and as our understanding of all these dynamics grew, I didn't have a psychological problem there. I was just hitting shots that I didn't have.
Right.
Like, I wasn't getting tight hitting the backhand down the line. I couldn't hit the backhand down the line off the ball machine.
Right, yeah.
Right, so the truth is, like, the hard, honest truth was, there wasn't, you know, some super complicated problem that I needed to have an Olympic class sports psychologist dissect with me for 100 hours.
Wait, is there psychology Olympics now? Is that a thing?
I just wasn't using this process. I mean, it's almost overly simple, where I simply didn't have that feedback loop. And I wasn't genuinely asking those questions of, okay, well, what's the data here? What are really my strengths and weaknesses? And how much am I really making the commitment to encourage play onto my strength and to avoiding my opponent's strengths?
Absolutely.
I really believe that I would have been probably 10 times the player. Maybe not 10 times, maybe 5 times. But I mean, I would have been a completely different player if I'd been doing that while I was, you know, whatever, earlier.
Well, there you have it, folks. So, in other words, do what we're saying and you'll become between 5 and 10 times the player.
Easiest guarantee you'll ever have.
Yeah, or your money for this podcast back, guaranteed. That said,
folks, does not include purchase of phone.
No, does not. So, folks, if you have any questions or comments, please do reach out to us. You, as always, can reach me at glenn@tacticaltennis.com.
And I'm jacob@tacticaltennis.com, and you can find us on Instagram @tacticaltennis.
And also on Twitter @tacticaltennis. And if you haven't yet, please go on to iTunes or whatever program you are using to listen to podcasts and rate the Tactical Tennis Podcast, because we're not advertising. We don't have an advertising budget per se. And that's really the only way that we grow is if you take this podcast and you share it with one of your tennis friends, then that helps us. That helps the podcast grow. And ultimately, I think that helps you. So, you know, please do us a favor. Share with a friend. Share with a family member or a tennis buddy. And outside of that, have a great day.
See you later, guys.